My name is Chris Grum, and the reason that I am with you today talking about this particular subject matter, which is AIDS, is because I am the executive director of an organization called Education Program Associates. And besides doing a series of work and training with healthcare workers in reproductive health, we also do a lot of work around AIDS. In fact, we just finished a study of the California prison system, which houses about 65,000 prisoners. It's the fourth largest prison system in the world, looking at their AIDS education program and what they teach and train both their prisoners and their staff. And it's pretty depressing, I will tell you. It's pretty minimal, and there are a lot of problems in terms of AIDS within that department. But besides that, we also do training of AIDS education for workers working in the field of reproductive health. We develop materials and have very close connections with a lot of the AIDS organizations in California. Now, what we're going to do today is we're going to focus on the ethical issues related to AIDS and the impact of AIDS on our public health policy in this country. So we're not going to talk so much about individual cases related to AIDS, but we're going to deal with it in terms of the entire impact it's made on our society and things that you and your children and your children's children are going to be experiencing from the effects of AIDS that we're only now beginning to see. But I want to remind you, before we get started, we again have our list of ethical considerations, both for, these are the medical considerations, and we talked about this, informed consent. Before anything gets done to you medically, you should know what is being done. Confidentiality, this is one we're going to focus on today also. That is the confidentiality relationship between the doctor-patient that's always been held in high regard. That's radically changing with the issue of AIDS. Risk-benefit ratio, what are the risks and benefit of using certain medication or surgery? That's also a key discussion we're going to have because there are a lot of experimental drugs out now around the issue of AIDS, and the risk-benefit ratio is getting mixed. Justice and equal treatment. Everybody should have access to treatment. That's also an issue. Right to refuse treatment. That we will not talk about so much here. Then in terms of Christian convictions, the importance of life, the respect for others is a key one around the AIDS issue. Responsibility towards humanity and rest of creation is another key one. Accountability to God. What's our relationship to God, and what is it that that in that relationship is being said around the issue of AIDS and how we respond to it, and also the question of homosexuality, which also comes up when we're dealing with AIDS, although we're not going to be specifically focusing on homosexuality except as it relates to AIDS. And then, of course, the final one, which is the freedom of the gospel. In the midst of all of these ethical dilemmas, regardless of what decisions we make, we always know that we live in the forgiveness. And that's an important piece for us to remember and think about and focus on as Christians. It's one that we oftentimes forget. We like to do judgment. We're not so good at the forgiveness part, both of ourselves and other people. All right. Let me I give some background, as I always do, and then I do have a couple of cases that I want you to spend a little time on. Once again, an hour is a really difficult amount of time to not only talk about the issue of AIDS, but look a little bit at what's happened in terms of how we deal with epidemics in terms of our public health policy in this country. So I'm going to move through stuff fairly quickly. Just to get some statistics, so we get kind of the ramifications and the big picture, as I call it. In this country, we have over 75,000 reported cases of AIDS. Currently, it's a little over 75,000. It's predicted that there will be in the next 5 to 10 years between 700,000 and 1.5 million cases projected in this country alone. In the world, if you're looking at world figures, the figure of actual AIDS cases that have been reported is 200,000. Many people feel that's extremely low because the best reporting system currently is in the United States. In Africa, where AIDS is very, very high in a number of countries, the reporting system is not very good. Consequently, we're not getting very accurate figures from those from a lot of those different countries for a lot of different reasons. Within our country, about 63% of the cases st- still function within the homosexual and bisexual community. About 19% are what we call, and we'll use this term a lot, IV drug users. That means drug users who inject some form of drugs within their system. They're IV drug users. About 7% are a combination of gay IV drug users. This is a pretty small percentage. 1% hemophiliacs, and that's getting even smaller because our blood supply in this country is much more protected than it used to be. About 4% are heterosexual, 3% come from transfusions, and 3% are in an undecided category in terms of what risk group they fit into. The 4% heterosexual one, by the way, is increasing. And these statistics are true of our country. If you went to Africa, the majority of AIDS cases are in the heterosexual population, not in the homosexual or IV drug user population. So we need to be very careful how we label the disease, because it takes different forms in different countries. And why I say that is because it's really crucial to understand that a whole variety of people are at risk. And one of the tendencies of a lot of people is to say, well, I don't fit into that category, therefore I'm not at risk. Very often the issue of AIDS is not what group you fit into, but what kind of risk behaviors you perform. So it has less to do with the group you fit into and more to do with risk behaviors. A couple of things just that I think are important to remember. If you look at the category of ages in this country in terms of AIDS itself, there's one I want to really pull out. Between the ages of 20 and 21, and this is one of the categories, by the way, that's increasing. About a year ago, it was 21% between the ages of 20 and 29. That has jumped. It's one of the categories that's moving up. Who are those people? When are those people getting AIDS?
As teenagers,
exactly. That's a very, very major concern for public health officials these days, is that's the category that is increasing. Now, you tie that together with the high number of teen pregnancies in this country, which is about 1 million a year, and you are talking about a major risk group. Then you tie that into the fact that about 2% of all high school students have tried some kind of IV drug use. You put those two groups together and you've really increased that. And the third factor is you're dealing with a population that doesn't believe they can get AIDS because they never see their friends with AIDS. Because usually it doesn't manifest itself until you're in your 20s. So consequently, it's very, very difficult to do good education. It's also a group that does not use very well the one method of birth control that is the greatest protection against AIDS if you choose to be sexually active, which is a condom. So all of those factors together make it problematic for that particular group of people, and I think it's something we need to look at. In terms of AIDS, about 85-89% in this country are men, 11% are women. That's another category that's changing. A lot more women are becoming positive due to the increase in number of drug users, IV drug users that are becoming positive, and their partners then become positive. Projected cases. By 1991, they project 240,000 cases in this country. I want you to keep that figure in your mind, because when we start talking about cost, you need to multiply that times the cost. They figure deaths will be about 179,000. So we are indeed talking epidemic proportion.
Of that 240,000, you said 179 will die?
No. There'll be 179 deaths by the year. By the year 1991. Right. So they haven't figured in necessarily all the deaths or all the AIDS cases. Now the people have died before that time. So it's just projected. But currently, mortality rate, death rate for AIDS is 100%. That's currently the figure.
That's what I wanted to clarify.
Yeah, right. There are regional differences between statistics. For instance, on the West Coast, there's a higher number of the gay population who have AIDS. On the East Coast, there's a higher number of the heterosexual population and IV drug users who have AIDS. In fact, in New York City, they figure that close to 60% of the heroin users are infected. It's a huge, huge number. San Francisco is much smaller, 16%. LA is much smaller, and they haven't figured out why the IV drug using population on the West Coast has not been as impacted, frankly. Nobody really has the answer to that. It was predicted that it would be impacted, but they haven't actually figured that out. The city that they do think is going to be hit the hardest in the next 10 years is probably Los Angeles. But as we know, AIDS is everywhere. It's not just confined to those cities. So it's very important that we remember and understand that it's not just in New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles. You know, it's in Chicago, it's in Northfield, it's in Minneapolis, you know, it's in Albuquerque. It's all over. The statistics oftentimes are much better for those cities and the larger populations. Okay, that just gives you a picture kind of the big picture. Oh, let me just say this real quick, too. There are, can somebody name for me the various ways that you can get AIDS? What's one? Huh?
IV drug use.
IV drug use, so needles. Blood transfusion, so the exchange of blood products. Whether it's through a blood transfusion or whether it's through IV drug use? What?
Intercourse.
Okay. Anything else?
Through the placenta.
Through the placenta, exactly. Well, a woman who is pregnant can transfer it to her baby. Although, you know, it's not 100%. There are many cases where an AIDS-infected woman will have twins. And one twin will have AIDS and the other will not. And they don't know why. They don't know why. That's happened fairly frequently in Africa.
Isn't it generally a transfer of body fluids?
Yes. Yes.
Any way that can happen.
Right. Although the when we talk about that, a lot of people are concerned about saliva. And saliva, that is not a major issue. I mean, you have to, I think they figured out once you have to have a gallon of saliva that's AIDS infected to get into another person's body. And then the transfer of that. In our country, we've basically wiped out, as I said, we've cleaned up the blood supply pretty well. Nothing's 100%, but it's been cleaned up. In Africa, that's not as true. In Africa, the blood supply is still creating a lot of the transmission of AIDS. Actually, AIDS is pretty hard. In if you look at the issue of communicable diseases, other communicable diseases, for people to get. I mean, you have to go through one of those three processes in order to get AIDS. So we need to remember that, too, when we talk about making public policies. Yeah? Because AIDS, the AIDS virus is not very strong and dies pretty easily. And so, therefore, the blood supply is a much better place for the AIDS virus, where the saliva is not. So you really have to have a great amount of saliva with the virus in it in order for it to be transmitted. That's the thing about AIDS. It is a very, very weak virus in some ways, even though we think of it as a very strong virus. Okay, I'm going to take two more questions if they're real quick, and then I'm going to move on.
This needle bit, is it because they use the needles aren't sterile?
Yeah, because they use each other's needles.
Oh, right.
Exactly. They share needles.
Uh-huh.
Right, right. And that's one of the big problems, by the way, in prisons. Where use of drugs is very, very high. That's one of the issues.
They use sterile needles.
Because the prisons don't allow them to have sterile needles, don't allow them to have needles, period.
They would.
Yes, or they bleach the needles, sterile needles, yes. In fact, that's one of the controversies we're going to talk about.
Uh-huh.
Do you give drug addicts sterile needles?
Uh-huh.
Okay, one quick question back there, or comment.
What about in the hypodermic
needles? Yeah. They have not, that has not been proven. The CDC basically has not in all of their studies and all of the cases proven that to be a way that it's transmitted. And it's an issue that's out there, but the CDC does not say that is how it's transmitted. Oh, you mean if you get infected?
Yeah.
If you get infected, it's it could be up to 11 years before you actually have any symptoms of the disease itself. You can test much earlier for the AIDS antibodies, and that's what the test is. It tests for AIDS antibodies. But you could have 11, in fact, the studies now are showing even longer periods. It used to be thought, it started out 5, then it went to 7, then it went to 9. Now I think the latest one that I read recently was about 11.
The parameters of infection may be a lot larger than what we know of
Exactly. It's all a guessing game. Okay, I need to, let me move on to this, and then we're going to have a chance to talk about that. ethical dilemmas related to AIDS. There are two things that have always been very, very important. One is the privacy in terms of our healthcare system. One is the privacy of the medical decision making. In other words, the ability of a person to make a decision without interference from the state. And two is patient-doctor confidence. The ability of the patient and the doctor to talk about issues, and that confidence is kept very carefully. In fact, it's even covered and supported by the law. All of those things, quite frankly, have radically changed in the issue of AIDS for a number of reasons. It's forced us to acknowledge that that model may not be workable, or in some cases, the state's pushing it not to be workable. The ethical dilemmas have just increased since 1981, which is when the first AIDS case was acknowledged in this country. And one of the problems for us around our health care in relationship to AIDS is that there is currently no cure. And we have come to live in a society where we think everything is curable. So that when the AIDS epidemic hit, it was really problematic for our country because we always thought of epidemics which killed large numbers of people as happening where? Third world countries. That's where it takes place. We never thought of ourselves as having epidemics that in fact would kill large numbers of people. And if we did have an epidemic, we always seemed to have a cure. In other words, for sexually transmitted diseases, when we got gonorrhea and syphilis, we got penicillin. And we were able to wipe that out pretty much until they decreased the funds and it came back again. But we've never seen ourselves as a country in recent times, in the last 25 to 30 years, as being a country that is going to be devastated. Even with polio, we came up with a cure. We came up with a way to vaccinate people. So it's been a problem for us to deal with that, to deal with the issue of what's happening with AIDS and the fact that we're kind of out of control. We really don't know what to do with AIDS in many cases. So in some cases, we panicked, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. However, in order to understand our response to AIDS as a country, we need to understand how we've dealt prior to about 1940 with the issue of communicable diseases, things like smallpox, yellow fever, cholera, typhoid, leprosy. Prior to 1875, there were no health departments. So local cities, whoever had the power, if there was an outbreak of smallpox or cholera, then they made a decision and said, okay, let's burn down that half of town, clean it out. Those people have to stay over there. They can't come over here. And the courts weren't much involved. After, between 1875 and 1910, almost all states developed health departments. And currently, during that time, the courts supported states quarantining and isolating people. And there were a number of different things that were accepted as constitutional. We did not focus so much on people's individual rights, partially because who were the victims most frequently of those diseases? They were poor people, immigrants, children, and oftentimes the law and what happened in the courts related to the population rather than the disease itself. For instance, in San Francisco at one time, they required the entire Chinese population to get inoculated against smallpox. Nobody else in the city except for the Chinese population. Now, that became a problem, and that was eventually struck down. But that happened over and over again, and in some cases, the courts held it up. And in some cases, the courts didn't. But the limited individual rights became a key issue for this particular situation. There was one case called the Kirk case, which is a woman in South Carolina, this was upheld, who had leprosy, who was, they upheld a lifetime isolation of this woman. She was relegated to a lifetime of isolation because she had leprosy. She could not go near people. She had to live in a certain part of town. Her food was delivered in a certain way. All of those things, and the courts upheld that particular ruling, even though they knocked down a fair number of other ones. So the courts were somewhat scattered, But individual rights didn't have a lot to do with it. Between 1910 and 1940, we began to see mandatory testing of communicable diseases. One became the issue of the testing of children and the vaccinating of children, which if any of you remember the history, it was a major fight to get that happen. There was also testing of sexually transmitted disease, which is why today, what happens when you go to get your marriage license? You get a blood test for sexually transmitted disease. Now, that's where that comes from. Frankly, the blood test for a premarital blood test in this day and age doesn't really make a lot of sense. Frank, I mean, it doesn't screen out a whole lot because people's sexual patterns have radically changed. But also between 1910 and 1940, we saw a number of cases of involuntary sterilization because public health officials decided that the criminals, the mentally ill, and anybody else who kind of, the retarded, anybody else who fit into that category should be sterilized in order to not produce more of, quote, their kind. 22 states in this country had forced sterilization laws on their books where those people could get sterilized. If you go into certain communities, for instance, Native Americans, the number of Native American women who have been sterilized is outrageous. It's extremely high in comparison to the rest of the society. And basically, it comes under some of these laws. So individual rights became, for certain people, high priority, for other people, low priority. Then in the 40s, that changed. And the court began to say, there are individual rights that cannot be touched. We cannot make a decision for the state and totally wipe out those individual rights. And number two, you know what the other thing that happened? The courts decided that they didn't always believe the scientists and the medical people. And so those two things greatly influenced what happens in the courts. So here we are in 1980, and AIDS hits. And how do you think we did as a country in dealing with the AIDS crisis? We freaked. We freaked out. People went nuts. They did not know what to do. The basic methods, we'd always track communicable diseases. We had, you know, certain ways that we kept records and we kept track and all those kinds of things, but that's not what we did this time. This time, we had moral outrage. And who were we really angry at? Exactly. And so we moved a public health issue into the arena of the courts and politics before we ever chose to deal with it as a public health issue. Consequently, there were the federal government and state governments were all going past each other when it came to how money was spent. They spent 18 months arguing between the Center for Disease Control and Washington over a pamphlet that many of you may have gotten in your homes. How many of you received a pamphlet in your home? 18 months it took them to write that pamphlet, and you know why? They were arguing as to whether they could use the word condom in it or whether they could use the word homosexual in it. They sat and argued over the fact that if we are going to educate about AIDS, the one group said the only way we'll educate is say homosexuality is wrong, sex out of marriage is wrong, and that's basically how we'll educate. And another side says, hey folks, we're here to stop AIDS, not to legislate morality. That in fact people don't do well being educated under those circumstances. It becomes a problem when you try to develop materials. We developed a series of materials, as I mentioned before, for the state prison system. And in the state prison system, even though AIDS is very problematic, you're not allowed to, they will not distribute condoms, even though they know that sexual encounters are taking place in the prisons. So we had to write a booklet that talked about how to protect yourself from AIDS using condoms, never once talking about it or saying the word or showing it. And so you had to use all kinds of devices. We invented this story and, I mean, you know, amazing kinds of things. And we did test it with the prisoners and it with the inmates, and it worked very well. But that's the problem. Or the issue of the number of, you talked about needle sharing. Prisoners, the use of drugs in prisons is rampant. It's rampant. But prisoners are not given sterile needles. They're not given bleach to, in which to clean their needles. Consequently, we're talking about the passing of the virus in a much more productive way than it would be in other places. The problem is we developed no leadership in this country around AIDS, and probably would have continued having major problems if one person had not come on the scene. Who was? Coop. Coop, who started out to be a very, and was thought to be when he was appointed to the Surgeon General position, to be a very conservative physician who was not supportive of homosexual lifestyle, a whole lot of things. What they forgot to ask Coop about was this. His bottom line was he was a public health physician. And basically he saw AIDS as a public health issue. And his argument all along was, I don't believe in homosexuality. I don't believe in sex out of marriage. But if we're going to fight this, we have to fight it with reality-based, which is, I have to talk about homosexuality and the use of condom because that's the group in which the disease is happening. I have to talk about IV drug use and et cetera, et cetera. We have to talk about sex education. It was Coop who dramatically changed how we began to look at AIDS in this country. Now, one of the reasons we went so nuts about it is because AIDS is a disease that carries with it an incredible amount of baggage. And we always talk about the issue, we're going to talk about confidentiality. The reason confidentiality is so important is because many people with AIDS or who test positive, if it's found out, things like this occur. They lose jobs. They lose houses. In fact, in Dallas, there was realtors were listing those houses in which people with AIDS had died, and they were listed that way in terms of housing in real estate. AIDS patients were, when they died, funeral homes refused to bury them. There was a loss of standing in the community. There was a loss of friends. There was a denial of medical treatment. There was a loss of health insurance. And probably most painful, a major loss of families. And in many cases, if you were in San Francisco or have been, it's not unusual to have a person with AIDS who is never told their family that they're gay, and they haven't told them they have AIDS. So as they're dying, the family comes out, and the first two pieces of news they hear are, your son is gay, your son is dying from AIDS. And it's a very, very painful situation. In fact, a friend of mine that was going to come up with me this week had to stay because he's responsible for an AIDS client who is dying, who has not been in touch with his family for 7 years. And the person is in a stage right now of dying that he has no idea what kind of health care. He can't make decisions. So the question is whether his family should be called, a family that has basically rejected him for the last 7 years. So, you know, in the midst of dying and that pain, all of those other issues also are coming up in terms of lack of support from the families. So those are things that are happening. We have a fragmented healthcare system related to this, and we have a lot of bills in the legislature that are beginning to crop up. For instance, in Florida, one of the bills was requiring the health department to name every child with AIDS and every school employee with AIDS and make that public. That was that bill did not pass, but it's still on the floor. In Illinois, there was a proposal to have a central registry where you had all AIDS, people with AIDS or testing positive in that registry with the possibility of quarantining them. So that was another bill. In California, there was an initiative that fortunately lost, which required mandatory testing of everybody. Not just high-risk groups, the entire population of 200 million people. And we're going to talk about that in a minute because what the ramifications of that are incredible. Normally, the strategies for a communicable disease are you start tracing. You have some kind of a mechanism by which you can trace. This person got the disease, then they infected this person, then they infected this person, then they infected this person. What do you think is problematic with that system in AIDS? Delay. It doesn't work because you can have an 11-year gap. We're not talking about a sexually transmitted disease like gonorrhea and syphilis that show up in terms of the symptoms much sooner. You're talking about tracing 11 years of somebody's life, which is almost impossible. Confidentiality is another issue. which becomes a problem. So all of those issues in terms of tracking don't work very well in the traditional way. You have a question? Oh, no. I mean, that you can pass on AIDS. You don't ever have to display the symptoms of AIDS and still pass it on. That's what's problematic around it. You can't, sure. I mean, there's about a six-month time period in terms of doing the test that the antibodies can show up. But as soon as as soon as the antibodies are in the body, then you can pass the virus on. So during that 11-year period of time, while there are no symptoms, that somebody could very easily give it to another person. You don't only pass it on when you have the symptoms. That's what makes it such a difficult disease to get a handle on. I mean, that's why it's so problematic. Then there is general isolation or quarantine. Quarantine is usually when you put together people who you think might get the disease, the high-risk people. Isolation is usually where you put aside the people who actually have the disease. Now, how is general quarantine going to work with the kind of figures we talked about? Tell me where you're going to quarantine potentially 1.5 million people. And for 11, 12, 13 years. We're not just talking a small amount of time. So even the concept of doing that doesn't work very well. It's one of the things that we have to look at. One of the other issues that's come up is isolate those people who do not exercise proper behavior. In other words, people with AIDS or who test positive who are having unsafe sex. Or who are, you know, sharing needles. So now you'd have to go around and find out those people and then set aside a place and put them in that place. I mean, it boggles. Those traditional ways of dealing with the communicable disease do not work very well. Then, of course, we have the issue of mass screening. Now, first of all, the cost of mass screening is insurmountable. That means every single one of you, all of your children, your parents, your grandparents, everybody you know in your community goes off to the local health department and get screened. Okay? But you know the problem with that? 1 year later, they'd have to do it all over again to pick up the 5 to 10% more. And then a year later, they'd have to do it again. And a year later, they have to do it again. So mass screening doesn't work very well. It's one of the problems related to people getting screened and being required to screen before they go into surgery. Because if somebody comes up with a negative test and say they got infected between the time they took the test and the time they went into surgery, the people in surgery are going to assume that this person is negative and not function with all the safety precautions. That's one of the arguments around it. Other health workers, on the other hand, say, I would like to at least know what's happening. So those are some of the issues that tug and pull at people. It's not an easy situation to figure out. So far, the only way to prevent AIDS is through education. And that's the main source of, that's the main issue that we have to focus on. And we are far behind most countries. We are far behind most European countries because we've spent so much time arguing about what kind of education we should have. Therefore, our systems are not very well in place. It's scattered education. Some happens in high school, some doesn't. Some happens in the public, some doesn't. So it becomes a problem. Last, before we deal with some focused issues, cost. The cost of treatment of a person with AIDS is between $27,000 and $147,000. To use the drug, AZT, is between $8,000 to $10,000 a year to use the drug. Chances are most people with AIDS cost the healthcare system about 20% more than any other diseases on that large scale. There's no federally organized way to deal with AIDS clients. So you know where they end up? They end up concentrated in cities. San Francisco is one of them because they have one of the best healthcare systems. New York is awful. New York does not, a lot of people don't get good treatment in New York. So they go to other places, and small towns are almost impossible to get the kind of AIDS treatment that is necessary. Direct costs in 1986 were $1.1 billion. In 1991, they project that they'll be $8.5 billion. So from $1.1 billion to $8.5. Indirect costs in 1986, that means, you know, whether it's housing or food stamps for people with AIDS, et cetera, who've lost their jobs, is $7 billion. In 1991, it's going to be $55.6 billion. We are basically bankrupting with the issue of AIDS, both our current medical insurance system and our welfare system, and we're going to have to look at that and see what we need to do with it. Just real quickly, some issues that face healthcare people. One is the issue of confidentiality. There are a lot of people who do not chart that somebody is tested positive, because for the person in the clinic, the chart is a way for clients to see what one client is doing versus the other. However, those charts can all be subpoenaed in the courts by insurance companies, and people can lose their insurance over that. There are occupational risks that healthcare workers have to deal with in terms of working with AIDS, although those numbers are pretty small. There are testing issues, as we talked about, and one of the major problems in this country is that we basically have limited our education to white males who are gay, that the black community and the Hispanic community have had limited education focused on them because we have less concern in many ways. Basically, I worked with a group, and one of the things we were talking about was prisoners who have AIDS, and some of the group said, hey, why not just let them die? Why not just let them die? There are people who have committed crimes against society. They chose to be where they are. Why don't we just let them die? Frankly, that person mouthed what a lot of people think in here. And it becomes apparent by the way prisoners are treated who have AIDS in the prison system. So those are some of the ethical issues, the issue of confidentiality, the issue of testing, the issue of quarantine, the issue of education, experimentation with a variety of drugs. Finally, what's the Christian Church's role been in the issue of AIDS? Worse than that. Worse than that. Incredibly judgmental. And what's happened basically is a number of the fundamentalist churches and Jerry Falwell and other leaders have said up front that they don't think any federal funds should be used for research in AIDS or for treatment of AIDS because basically homosexuals are sinning against God and this is their punishment and they should take their punishment and the state should not pay for it. Now, Jerry Falwell and other leaders have said that openly. Frankly, other Christian churches have just kept silent. And to the point that a number of families that have come from churches in other parts of the country that come out and find out that their sons are gay and have AIDS go back and lie to the friends about what they died from. I know a woman whose son died, went back to her home congregation in Minnesota, and had the funeral for her son. They talked about his being gay. Nobody, this woman had been a member of that parish for 25 years. Not one person in that parish called that woman for 6 months after that funeral. Not one person. This is a Lutheran parish. And there are stories after stories. There's a story of a family that actually hired a woman to act the part of a fiance of the son so that they could go home, even though the son died young, and say that they were just about ready to be married and make up an entire story about them. I mean, the stories are endless. So while maybe we didn't make the statement that said homosexuals should be punished for their sins or IV drug users should be punished, we oftentimes practice that on a day-to-day basis. We're beginning to change that. There's beginning to be some education. But one of the issues we have to deal with is, why is it that we isolate the issue of AIDS and homosexuals and IV drug users and talk about sin there when we don't do that to cancer patients, to heart disease patients, and on and on? We need to be very careful that we are not the ones sitting in judgment. Only God sits in judgment. We need to deal with this as compassionate people, regardless of how we feel about the issue of homosexuality. And there are certainly people on both sides of the issue that also can be very compassionate with people with AIDS. And that's one of the things that we need to begin to look at as a church, how we relate to that, what we want to say to the world, and what we want to say to the people within our church. Okay. Any questions or comments before we go into the case study? Yes.
Denying that homosexuality is immoral.
What about if you weren't good stewards of your body and ate the wrong kind of food and didn't exercise right and had a lot of stress? I mean, there's a lot of that related.
Smoking is right either. A lot of people get cancer from smoking.
Right. So
but
that, you know, similar thing.
He doesn't mention tobacco smoking, but he specifically mentions homosexuality is an abomination, period.
But God does specifically mention being good stewards of your body. And that, you know,
right.
There are all kinds of things that we can do. The problem for us that we need to deal with is how do we deal with this problem in terms of compassionate listeners? We are compassionate people. As we said before, it's God who sits in judgment. It's we who function within the world to see how we struggle through these particular issues. Yeah, one comment and then we're going to go to the case. All right, let me give you a case and let's see what you can do with it. This is one that actually comes up quite frequently. This is the issue of confidentiality, and you need to put yourself in the mind of a doctor who his entire life she has been taught that the confidentiality, the relationship between the patient and the doctor is sacred, and that she's aware that the client would not show up at her door if he felt that she was not able to keep his confidences. So here is the case. Dr. Martin has just told Jim that he has tested positive. Jim is married and has 2 children. He does not want to tell his wife about the test and has asked the doctor not to inform his wife about the test. The doctor knows how to contact the wife, but is bound by the confidentiality relationship of the doctor-patient. What would you do if you were the doctor? Now, I really want you to put yourself in the shoes of the doctor who truly believes in the issue of confidentiality. So that's one question. What would you do? The second question is, should all people with AIDS be forced to be on a central registry and, you know, somehow in some computer someplace be listed? And how should the church respond to the issue of people with AIDS and the issue of confidentiality? Okay, get in groups of 4. This was an easy one. All right, get in groups of 4, and I'll give you about 5 or 6 minutes. Okay, you want to stop for a minute? You can just stay, go ahead and stay in those groups. But let's stop for 1 minute. How many of you, if you were the doctor, would go and tell the wife? How many of you, if you were the physician, would go and tell the wife? Okay. How many would not?
We're talking right now.
Right now.
Right now. Right. Okay. Okay, let's talk about kind of both. The people who would tell the wife, what were some of the things that you thought of as you were as you made that decision? Yeah. Okay. So for you, it was kind of a question of weighing which one, you know.
It's his responsibility to do it. You shouldn't protect the doctor.
Okay. But if he didn't, you think the doctor should do it?
Yeah, that's
the problem. That is, in fact, the issue of confidentiality, folks. Part of the reason confidentiality is so crucial is because if it did not exist, people would not go and see physicians. That a lot of the issues that we've talked about would be much more limited. People would see it at a much later time, et cetera. And it's one of the problems around the question of breaking confidentiality between the doctor-patient, because it really radically changes medical practice. Okay, I want to do another quick one. I know there's a lot of discussion, but another quick one that I think even hits closer to us. Yeah. Oh, okay. Let's right.
Well,
that was there. Okay. Usually, nobody gets to that. So, great. Go ahead. So you think, for instance, if we talked about it, if we made it a more open subject within our church, and that person were a member of our church, that maybe they would feel more inclined to share it because they'd feel some kind of support. But what does that require in a church? That's right.
Yes.
It really requires accepting a person. It doesn't mean that there might be issues and behaviors in that person that you might speak to them about, but it does require unconditional love and the kind of love that we have in our relationship with Christ. And we really need to struggle with that as people of God in terms of our ability to do that, particularly in a situation like this that's really scary oftentimes for a lot of us. It's scary because our families may be affected by it. And it's scary because we want to protect people we love. So it's a really difficult issue. That's a real good point. Yeah?
What about the fact, though, that only minority of the population, you're just not going to get in place?
Well, it depends upon, there are a lot of different organizations that are working on it. I think if the church concentrated on its members, we'd be pretty surprised at the number of its members that are impacted by this disease. Maybe it's not the actual person. Maybe it's the parent of the person who has to go out and see that person out there. Maybe it's the, you know, uncle. Maybe it's the children of. You know, we impact a lot of other people that never walk into our church doors. And what great kind of, you know, feeling that you can give a person if you were to say from the pulpit or otherwise publicly within your church, we're supportive. And if this happens in your family, we are here to be with you, to be supportive, to help you work through in that relationship what happened in the process. That, I mean, that's what we can be concerned about. Maybe it's only a small group, but boy, I tell you, if we start affecting that, we've at least started a process in which we're functioning and working that makes some sense. And I think that's what we need to deal with. Yeah. What are the places that the church can play of the most crucial role besides education and members is to be there. A lot of people with AIDS when they are dying are looking for some kind of spiritual guidance. They're looking for somebody to say, God loves you regardless. And we have a hard time doing that. And it's only within the church oftentimes. I hear doctors all the time who deal with people with AIDS who say, we can't deal with that spiritual part. We can deal with the body. We can deal with kind of getting their spirits up. But when it comes to that part of their struggle with death and what that means for them, we have seen many cases where people with AIDS are just crying out for other members of the Christian community to be a part of that process. And we need to be there. They may not be members of our congregation, but they are members of our community.